The Knoxville Symphony Orchestra is presenting a Moxley Carmichael Masterworks Series concert this Thursday and Friday nights, an all-Mozart performance featuring Canadian violinist Laura St. John, who will be playing Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 4. A few days ago, I got the chance to sit down and talk a few minutes with Ms. St. John. You began playing the violin at the age of 2 and then had your debut as a soloist with an orchestra at the age of 4. Do you have any memories of this time, or at least like photographs that sort of jog your memory?
Well, I do have some photos of that debut. And to be specific, I was actually 2 and a half when I began. I mean, a half year is a fifth of your life at that point, so it does actually make a difference.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't actually remember exactly starting, but I guess I don't remember any time in my life without a violin. So I suppose I do kind of remember in a way.
Do you remember what you played at your orchestral debut?
I actually played the Bach concerto, the Bach double concerto, with my brother.
Wow.
Yeah, he was 6.
That's not a simple piece, really.
No, and there is a recording of it. I mean, obviously, the violin when you're that young is quite a bit smaller.
Right.
I think at that point, by the time I was 4, I'd probably graduated to a 16th size.
Uh-huh.
I think I started on a 32nd.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, wow. I mean, just by the fact that it's so tiny, it just can't sound good. I mean, it just kind of is so squeaky, like a little mouse or something.
It seems that your playing progressed really quickly as a child. You gave your European debut at 10 years old, toured Europe at 12 and 13, and then entered the Curtis Institute at the age of 13. How many hours a day were you practicing?
Well, that kind of fluctuated in my sort of younger life. Obviously, when I was sort of 6, 7, or 8, I think sort of 45 minutes was considered a good day kind of thing. And then it especially when the teenage years began, then it went up a little bit. I think it was at about 10 or 11 when I really decided, oh, I'm really interested in this music and I want to do this for myself. You know, at that point, I started really working for the music and for myself and stuff. So I've never gone over, I don't think, you know, it's a loaded question, especially parents ask me this all the time. But I've never gone over about 3 hours a day. And in my opinion, that's the limit for what you can do for quality work.
Mm-hmm.
And people who come up to me and say, oh, my kid practices 8 hours a day. I'm like, well, that's just ridiculous. I mean, you can't be getting good stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but if you're spending 8 hours of your day doing basically what must be mindless violin playing, then in what way are you going to have a life
mm-hmm.
and become an artist or whatever? So I tend to think quality over quantity. And now, of course, I mean, I play so much that unless I have something to learn, I don't really practice very much at all, actually.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Actually, that was one of my later questions. You know, I noticed on your touring schedule that you don't perform the same concerto, generally speaking, in more than one city. It's like you have a repertoire that's varied. And I just kind of wondered, how much time do you spend in advance preparing for that performance? Or is it just in your fingers?
A lot are in my fingers because I play. I'm a girl who can't say no, I guess. So, you know, music directors will ask my management, okay, well, will she do this concerto or that concerto? And I always say yes. So actually, since the beginning of September, I believe this Mozart is my 7th concerto of the season.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe even 8th. I've been busy this fall. And I like it that way. I mean, I have a strange memory and a strange muscle memory and all this kind of stuff. So it doesn't really take all that much for me to reclaim a concerto that I've done before. And it just makes it much more interesting. You know, every week I'm doing a different piece, a different era, a different composer. So I don't know. I like it that way.
After graduating the Curtis Institute at the age of 17, I read that you went to Moscow to, quote, see if there was more to life than music. Was there?
Yeah, there was.
Can you talk about this experience or anything that you learned?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to date myself here, but I actually moved to the Soviet Union, possibly like the best year to be there because it was sort of post KGB and extreme communism and just pre Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a wonderful time. I mean, I learned just so much about life and about other cultures and another language, of course. And, you know, it was complete immersion.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the conservatory residence in Moscow. And so I took the opportunity to travel. I went to the Kazakhstan and to Armenia, to Georgia, you know, out to Hungary at a time which will never come back. So, I mean, I still think it was probably the best year of my life.
Do you have a standout memory from this experience?
Well, I mean, I was a little Canadian kid, you know, who had grown up in Philadelphia a little bit and then also in Canada and also in France. But I guess just sort of the appreciation of what hardship really is. You know, I was obviously in a much better situation than most Soviet folks at the time. But I think it was January, and none of us had actually seen a fruit for a very long time. And I saw a big line. And in Moscow at that time, when you saw a big line, you knew there was something worthwhile at the end of it. Mm-hmm. So I went to check out the front of the line, and it was bananas from Colombia. And I remember I almost started crying. I was like, I want to taste a banana so badly.
Wow.
So I actually had quite a lot of rubles with me, and you had a limit to how many you could buy. So I gave people rubles, and I said, listen, you know, you buy me a kilo of bananas, you take two for yourself, give me the rest. And so then I was waiting in line with like 10 people and mm-hmm. piled into a taxi with like, I don't know, 14 kilos of bananas, and went back to the residence and like, you know, tumbled out with all these bananas, and everybody came running. And it was just, it was sort of an amazing thing, because it just would never have happened in the States or in Canada or something. And I'm sure that sort of thing happens in too many countries still. But for me, it was an experience.
Can you tell us about the instrument that you play?
It's a JB Guadagnini from Turin, Italy, made in 1779. It's actually not mine. It's on loan from an anonymous donor, but I've been playing it for about 16 years now, so it's kind of an open-ended loan.
Did you discover it, or did the loaner just say, here you go?
Well, there was the Canadian government did a competition many years ago for a Strad, and I won that. So I played on this Stradivarius for 2 years. And the same donor had asked me to try out some of his instruments. And when I felt and heard this one, well, under the jaw, really, and in the fingers, I thought it was twice the instrument that the Strad was I was playing on.
Yeah.
Which is funny, because it's actually worth half the money. But for me, I don't care what the name is or who made it or anything like that. I just care about how it sounds. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and when I say half the money, that's like still $2 million or something. So, which is why I don't own it.
In 1999, you created your own record label, Ancaligon. Why did you decide to make this choice? Forgive me if I'm wrong, but at this time, independent labels weren't very common.
No, I think I was the first in the classical world, and actually one of the first at all, because even Radiohead didn't create their own till 2005. So I like to think I inspired them.
Yeah.
I wanted to have sort of a complete control over what it is that I recorded, how it was presented, how it was packaged, edited, done, you know. And I'm really, really happy that I did that all those years ago. You know, you hear these stories about labels that, I mean, friends of mine who are also soloists who say, oh, I had to record this piece. It was really stupid. I hated it. You know, I never wanted to be in that position of somebody telling me what to do. I wanted it to always be something that I could do with integrity mm-hmm. and with somehow belief behind it.
Can you talk a little bit about your recording method? You record a little differently than most studio musicians, correct?
Yeah, my philosophy is that a recording should sound like a great live performance. It shouldn't sound like it comes out of a can and like it's been edited to death. And I myself, I mean, well, obviously I have quite a lot of recording experience at this point, but I can tell when people have just sort of like taken this bit and then stitched them together, like, you know, this little quilt recording. As much as can be, I take it from beginning to end. And I sort of started this philosophy from Bach because, for example, in some of the longer movements, the 11-minute fugue, the 15-minute chaconne, if I hadn't started from the beginning, if I started in the middle, I would be at a completely different state of exhaustion than if I'd started at the beginning, or a different state of mind or whatever. And probably nobody else in the world would be able to tell, but I would.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what mattered to me. So for me, from beginning to end, like the arc of the whole. So at least every movement I do from beginning to end.
Do you prefer playing new music, new compositions, or classics like the Mozart concerto you're about to perform?
It's not really a question of preference. I mean, the Mozart, the fourth Mozart, I think the last time I did it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And every time I come back to it, it's just like, oh my gosh, could this be more charming. Like, it is just such a beautiful, perfect piece of music. Mm-hmm. And it's always a great joy. I mean, any of the Mozart concertos are. At the moment, I've been more and more interested for years in actually commissioning and creating stuff that wasn't there before I asked for it to be, which to me is very interesting, just for the simple reason that nobody's done it before, whatever that piece may be. So it's not like I prefer one or the other, though. Both things, doing classics, doing them again for a new audience with a new orchestra, a new conductor, there's always something to learn.
You are performing Mozart's fourth violin concerto in this concert. Does it have a cadenza in this?
Mozart didn't write one, no. Mm-hmm. So I basically, every time I do a Mozart concerto, I do a different cadenza. So I'd say for the big first movement cadenza, about 50% I know what I'm going to do, and 50% not quite sure.
So are you actually improvising the cadenza?
Yeah, more or less. Like, I know that I want to get from point A to point B, but how I'm going to do it, I'm not sure yet.
Wow, that's exciting.
It is. Well, that's what I say. It makes it different every time, and it makes it something to look forward to and possibly scratch your head later and say, what on earth was I just doing? But that's actually the way that they used to do it then. Mm-hmm. You know, it would come to the cadential 6-4, and the violinist would just go off for like 2 or 3 minutes, and it was never written down. It was always off the top of the head. So to an extent, it's kind of performance practice, really.
Yeah. Violinist Laura St. John, who is performing Mozart's fourth violin concerto with the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m., part of an all-Mozart program. Other works to be presented include the Idomeneo Overture and the Symphony No. 31. Performances will be given in the beautiful Tennessee Theater. More information at 291-3310 or at knoxvillesymphony.com.